now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Top 10.
That's right, Garrett Watley. It's actually part two of our top 10 show all about our all-time top comedy films.
Because there's been so many caveats in this. It hasn't just been a straight list. There's been divergent opinion, things that go around. How do we determine what was funny, what is funny, and what is funny yet to come?
Which I think is so important, because we've talked about on our show week after week that the comedy feature as a, I don't know, a big screen effort certainly seems endangered. So,
well, A, because the opinion that comedy doesn't sell overseas and more movies are made specifically for an overseas market.
Well, and the amount of time that it takes to make these things, and if you're chasing what's funny right now, then by the time it's done, it might not be funny.
Right.
So much goes into
and
it.
And also...
And the cost, the budget, the budget costs, you know? So we've covered those on other shows, but the point is there's fewer and fewer comedies that are coming out into theaters all the time. Certainly studio releases, fewer and fewer all the time. So what better time to champion... this great, perhaps greatest of all genres, most important of all genres.
Absolutely.
Comedy feature film. And where we left off, Dean, was literally halfway through the list. I had just completed regaling you, of all people, regaling you, teaching you about the brilliance of Buster Keaton, and specifically Sherlock Jr. That was my number six. So we pick up right there with your number five.
Right. And my number five, now, as we said, we're ascending back into history. But, you know, I always love you. I think are a big Mel Brooks fan. You
thought
Blazing Saddles was one of your best top westerns.
Yeah.
But for me, the ultimate Mel Brooks movie is Young Frankenstein, a parody of the horror movies of Frankenstein on down, done so it's not intricate, it's done lovingly. The black and white camera work, so phenomenal. Aside from the comedy, we all know the gags, we all know how brilliant Marty Feldman is as Igor, how great Gene Wilder is, Cloris Leachman, Terry Garr, everybody. And yet, to me, it's the filmmaking, the careful lighting and composition within the frame, even an intermission that's put in the film. All of these things kicking back to 1930 horror movies.
I'm not sure that it wasn't on my top 10 horror films when we did that, quite frankly.
Is that right?
Because like Blazing Saddles, it gives you all the thrills of it. It is loving in its approach to this, and understands it. It doesn't just love it. It understands how and why these films work. And,
right. And if you're ever looking for how to play it so real that you get laughs, look at Gene Wilder and how invested he is in denying he's a Frankenstein and then coming around to his heritage and loving his creation, all of it played almost so deeply emotional that it is one of the stellar comedy performances of a lifetime.
And how about if you're a big star, and people, big stars can get in their heads about comedy, but how you don't have to do anything, you know? Dear God, in heaven, Gene Hackman is such the textbook for a big star being hilarious and understanding you don't have to do anything. You know,
right.
Playing the blind man, hell, it's touching. It's actually touching, the sequence with Gene Hackman as the blind man. And I don't know about you, but one of the lines in movie history that it brings me joy, I always chuckle internally just thinking about this. One of the ones that it never fails, just thinking about this film will always make me think of this line, and this line always makes me happy, and it's just, put the candle back.
Yes. See, yeah, I know what you're saying. It's a hilarious, hilarious moment of hidden staircases.
Yeah. So simple.
It's so good.
Sometimes it's so simple. Yeah.
And you look at Kraft. I mean, it's interesting. I have the, I think I got the, not the 50th anniversary DVD, but the other one, I guess 25th. But in it, there's outtakes, things that were cut from the movie. Sequences, again, with the same camera work, same lighting, but for interesting reasons and very subtle reasons, don't work quite as well as other scenes do, and or don't really drive the narrative forward. And it is a testament to Mel Brooks about his commitment to gags and yet the ability to cut those gags if it's hindering the story. There's a tale of him having to fight for the musical number, putting on the Ritz of introducing the monster, and that it actually drove the narrative. Like, he had to argue that it was not superlative, but in fact it was a necessary, hilarious, and functional.
It wasn't
in
superfluous. It wasn't superfluous. It actually conveyed the story. Yeah, it moved the story along.
Yeah.
It really does. It really, really does. Yeah. And again, it's funny, and then it's touching.
Yeah.
And then it's heartbreaking and horrifying. I mean, it really
is like the Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein.
The original Frankenstein. Yeah. I actually think it's better than the original Frankenstein. I think it's equivalent to Bride of Frankenstein.
Ah,
yeah,
fantastic, yeah.
So
that's true, right?
From Mel Brooks to another filmmaker, another great comedic voice of the 1970s, who, like Mel Brooks, starts as a club comic, who, like Mel Brooks, makes a living as a writer during the golden age of television, like Mel Brooks, works as a writer on your show of shows, it's Woody Allen. I can't have a movie comedy list without Woody Allen. Now, I think the debate always goes back and forth between Annie Hall or Manhattan for people.
Right.
Annie Hall, big hit. Manhattan.
Lots of laughs, of gags.
Manhattan, a beautiful film. And Manhattan is a landmark for him. As I always point out, I always thought Woody Allen really nailed the end of the 70s and the end of the 80s with really fascinating landmarks for himself, because I thought Manhattan was where he learned how to make a serious comedy, make a comedy that was seriously affecting. And he ends the 80s... after making several great comedies during the 80s, but also several attempts at drama, sometimes Bergman-esque dramas. But he ends the 80s by learning how to make a drama that is hilarious, and that's Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Right.
But a few years before that, and it's surprising because when it first came out, it wasn't even my favorite Woody Allen of that half decade. It was maybe my third or fourth favorite Woody Allen of that half decade. And yet with each passing year, this one grows on me and more, and I am just drawn to the narrative perfection, the structural perfection of this movie, as well as one of my favorite things, you know, is a multifaceted cast, ensemble cast. And Hannah and Her Sisters has maybe the
really
most effective ensemble comedy cast I've ever seen. And this movie, it does it to me again and again and again. It's always fun. Michael Caine is never anything less than outrageously hilarious time and time again watching this movie. The Diane Wiest, Woody Allen romance sneaking up on you is so touching. Plus, isn't it great to see Thanksgiving scenes with a little girl running around and realizing, hey, that's Woody Allen's future wife.
Yeah. Is it great?
Yeah. But anyway, so Mia Farrow at her most luminous. I mentioned Michael Caine in an Oscar-winning performance too, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Barbara Hershey, so terrific. Diane Wiest in an Oscar-winning performance. The rest of the ensemble cast: Carrie Fisher, so funny, playing Mia Farrow's parents in that movie. The great Lloyd Nolan, who died just 4 months before the film came out. The great Maureen O'Sullivan. The movie also features Max von Sydow, Julie Kavner, Daniel Stern, Richard Jenkins, Fred Malamud, Louis Black, Joanna Gleason,
wow,
John Turturro, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Tony
Holy
Roberts,
crap,
Sam Waterston. It was for a long time Woody Allen's biggest box office hit. It won mm-hmm. Academy Awards, as I mentioned, for Best Supporting Actor, Best Supporting Actress, also for Best Original Screenplay. And like I said, it might be his best work as a writer. It is often considered as one of his major works, but I am going to put it out there as, instead of Annie Hall or Manhattan, my all-time favorite Woody Allen comedy, and it's number 5 on my list of the all-time great comedy features.
Well, you know, I think you're right, because it to me, it's the transition from where he still had his stand-up roots and still had comedy in his head, while at the same time transitioning to being a very good filmmaker. And, you know, the longer you look at the timeline of his movies, the more he got into filmmaking, and the farther away he got from his stand-up and his joke writing, the less, the difference the movies make. But to me, Hannah and Sisters is right in the middle of the balance of the two.
Because it's narratively how he learned it. I mean, he's still doing stand-up. Woody Allen's character plays a TV writer, for example, so he's able to do, and yet he brings such seriousness to that role. But
right,
narratively, it's so, it feels simple, but it's so complex, the way that all these seemingly disparate emotional storylines are revealed and constructed, and then the seemingly effortless way they all cross and come together again and again. We know that actually all takes a huge amount of work.
Right.
And the kind of energy and dedication and focus that he rarely, if ever, is willing to show over the last 10, 15 years.
Well, that's the thing.
Or longer even now, 20 years maybe. Right?
Yeah.
Maybe since Bullets Over Broadway or something like that.
Yeah. I'd say that's the last one. So there you go. Fantastic.
What's your number 4?
Number 4. Again, we talk about craft. We talk about the individual. For me, and also a movie that takes a very serious thing and tries to make a comedy about it. You know how I love that. This is Stanley Kubrick's classic with Peter Sellers, Dr. Strangelove, where Peter Sellers plays 3 fabulous, completely different characters all in the same movie, trying to stop a nuclear war from a B-52 that's gone rogue. And my God, how I love watching this movie over and over again, just to see the craft of Peter Sellers. You know,
well, there's so much. I mean, he plays three different characters that all seem to be, in a weird way, in their own movie. And
yeah, right.
And there are different movies within this movie. How about the kind of handheld 16mm black and white war documentary? You know, and then
yeah, when the base is getting attacked.
Yeah, and then the kind of James Bondian, you know. I don't know, larger than life, global espionage drama that you find yourself in. I mean, it's
really something. And then you go, okay, well, Peter Sellers is funny, but then look at the revelation that George C. Scott as the war hawk general. I mean, my God, just, I think I saw this first when I was taking drama classes. I forget when I first saw it, but I knew I was working very much on being on physicality as an actor. And to see George C. Scott walking backwards, pointing at this the big screen where all the planes are, and then seemingly falling and doing a somersault and rolling out of it, never dropping a line. That to me.
Now, doesn't that have to be a mistake? Doesn't that have to be, or was it not? Is that planned?
Well, here's the question, right? How, I mean, I have seen amazing clown work. I've seen amazing acting that has worked relentlessly to make it look effortless. So you can argue that George C. Scott had worked very hard to make that look like an accident, or in fact, it was an accident, and he's just so committed to the character that it didn't faze him. Either way, it's brilliant, regardless. And I would replay that over and over again to see that. Is it an accident or did he plan that?
Because this is a movie where there are, when things do go wrong in the making of this movie, they just get better. You know, you mentioned Peter Sellers' three performances. He's supposed to play four parts. And one of and one of them was so bad that they needed to recast it. So they get Slim Pickens to play the captain of the bomber that we're following. And who could have been better? I mean, how important is he to the success of this movie? I mean, for those people who don't know, it's based loosely on a thriller novel called Red Alert. And the story concerns, you know, an unhinged Air Force general who orders a first strike, a nuclear attack on the Soviet Union. And so then it follows the president of the United States, his advisors, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that's where George C. Scott is, there at the Pentagon, trying to decide what to do, trying to strategize with their counterparts in the Soviet Union to avoid an all-out nuclear war. And then it has a royal, and the president's played by Peter Sellers, then it has a Royal Air Force exchange officer at the base where this general went crazy. And that Royal Air Force officer is, again, Peter Sellers, trying to get the code so that he can recall the attack. And then the third major area that we're following is one of the bombers that does not get the recall order. So they're going ahead with the first strike. And for reasons that we learn, it won't just be one bomb. If they succeed, it is all out nuclear Armageddon. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. There's no pulling back from this. And the strange thing about this movie is you don't want the world to come to an end, and yet you're still rooting for this plane to succeed in to their mission. Through. And one of the reasons is because of Slim Pickens. You're rooting for him, even though you know that if he succeeds, it's the end of everything.
Well, and I think, you know, I listen a lot to Goon Show, which was Peter Sellers' BBC radio show with Larry Seacombe or Harry Seacombe. And oh, my gosh, I can't believe I'm forgetting Mr. Funny Voice. But he did a Southern accent on that show. And his Southern accent is very heavy. You know, it doesn't have that lightness and the twang that Slim Pickens has. So I could see that he probably filmed all of it in a B-52 but that you would not be rooting for the Peter Sellers Southern pilot character.
Yeah.
So I could see, even if it was recast, or even if he didn't want to do it, depending on which biography you've read of Peter Sellers, Slim Pickens makes all the difference to that juxtaposition of comedy and darkness of global annihilation.
Well, it is the kind of template for dark comedy. It's
yeah. You know,
it may not be the first, but it's the granddaddy of them all when it comes to dark comedy. The laughter that sticks in the back of your throat, you're laughing at things you should not, you're rooting for things you know you should not. That's darkly comedic, because what better way to expose the insanity of war, the thinking of the unthinkable, and not only the thinking of it, the planning for it, the entire industry built around planning for something that we should be doing everything to plan
not to do.
Not to do, yeah.
Yeah.
So my number four, also from the 1960s, another seminal work in the 1960s, like Dr. Strangelove, is the last movie to win Best Director and no other Oscars.
What?
How's that for a little bit of trivia there, a little Academy trivia?
Yeah, let me think of what that would play.
Yeah, 51 years ago, a movie won for Best Director and nothing else, and it was the second movie for director Mike Nichols. Can you imagine starting your career as a filmmaker with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and following it up with The Graduate?
Wow. The Graduate won no other Oscars except for Best Director.
It seemed like Mike Nichols was destined to go down as one of the all-time greats. I mean,
yeah.
That's as good a start to filmmaking as you can possibly have.
And
it's safe to say that he never again reached the heights he achieved, probably with either of those films, but certainly with this 1967 film, The Graduate, written by Buck Henry and Calder Willingham, based on the 1963 novel of the same name by Charles Webb. It follows a protagonist's transition from college graduation into adulthood. It's 21-year-old Benjamin Braddock, played by 30-year-old Dustin Hoffman, who was a last-minute replacement for Charles Grodin when Charles Grodin asked, "Can't I get more than scale for this?" Seeing as how I'm carrying this movie.
No, he did not.
Yeah, he did. So Dustin Hoffman, in what is a career-making role for him, obviously,
for sure,
plays this young college graduate with no well-defined aim in life, who's seduced by an older woman, and then falls in love with that older woman's daughter. And complications ensue. The film was released in December 1967, got great reviews, huge, unprecedented box office smash. It's, in fact, if you adjust for inflation, it's still, I think, the 20th highest ever grossing film in the U.S.
Wow. Did not realize that.
It is such a great marriage of, as you say, constructed gags. Some of these gags that Buck Henry constructs are so beautifully written, with a visual style that is so meticulously planned to both reveal the gags, to get the most out of the gags, but also to express the way this aimless man, and maybe an entire generation, experienced the world, how the world looked and sounded to Benjamin Braddock and to young people of the age. Mike Nichols never would take such a painstaking approach to depicting anything visually that way ever again.
Yeah.
But it's still, so now it's tinged a little bit with disappointment that, wow, this director never seemed to make another movie.
Well, because he did a lot of Broadway after this, if I recall correctly.
But it,
and
well, he did a lot of movies, and they just didn't. I mean, he tried some things with Carnal Knowledge, and but
oh, that's right.
But he never was this director again. And yet, at the same time, so even though it's a little bit sad, it does, along with movies like Citizen Kane, Mike Nichols' work on this teaches me the power of ambition. And I hope someday to have enough ambition to so meticulously depict, create a visual approach, especially for comedy. My God, to do it with this. And it's both a time capsule piece of the era and at the same time still, to me, feels remarkably fresh and modern.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I think, I mean, I'm thinking now in terms of construction, the phone booth to the lobby to when they're setting up their first evening in the hotel, that to me is not just clever in so many ways, but just in terms of camera placement of what's over the shoulder, where is the phone booth in conjunction with the lobby of the hotel, all of that. Is that meticulousness you're talking about?
The use of editing, jump cuts, and then smash cuts, and hidden transitions between locations are amazing. Yeah. You think you're following a character in a seamless shot, and suddenly they're walking from one location to another. And how about the use of Simon and Garfunkel on the soundtrack? Their songs, which are very interesting. It reminds me of why McGoohan went to the Beatles for the final episode of The Prisoner, because he wanted the music both to be something that was of the time, but also something that could never date it. And his reasoning was that the Beatles would always be timeless. Well, the same can be said of Simon and Garfunkel. This stuff is timeless. And their voices are a very important character in this film.
How about that? Fantastic.
So that's my number four. What's your number three, Dean?
My number three is, well, you know, we can't talk comedy movies without talking the Marx Brothers. And there's so many to choose from. Most of their, you know, stage shows were made into movies. And a few others. And I know I talk extensively about Night at the Opera and the work and craft that went into that one. But for me, the one that stands out, and since we're on a theme of war movies, is their hilarious Duck Soup, a story that roughly is an anti-war comedy, believe it or not, because there is the two fictitious countries that go to war, the mockery of the pre-political manifestations that lead them into war, and then the actual battles themselves that include jumping dolphins and funny cutaways. To me, it's the Marx Brothers' best in terms of funny lines and the sheer anarchy on screen that just jumps right into the audience. It's so funny.
Do you happen to know if... there's so many wonderful little pieces about the film Duck Soup. You know, especially the myth that is developed that it was a flop. It opened to mixed reviews, and it was a box office disappointment compared to their earlier films. But it was not a flop. It was a success. I am curious as to whether you know. We know that it was the last of the Marx Brothers movies released by Paramount Pictures. We know it was the last film to feature Zeppo, right? To be billed as the four Marx Brothers, right? But Rufus T. Firefly is the name of the character that he plays, Groucho, in it.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that's a reference to Rufus B. Von Kleinschmidt, the president of the Breakfast Club. At the time.
Was that the Breakfast Club character?
President at that time was Rufus B. Von Kleinschmidt, who was also the president of USC and of the Hollywood Bowl. And
well, you know, Groucho did keep horses, so it wouldn't be outside the realm of unbelievability.
Yeah, Rufus T. Firefly. I feel like that might be so.
Oh, I would think.
I need
you know
to
what?
Find
I'm
that out.
I'm going to say it is.
I need to look into that.
Yeah, we have no way of knowing. And, of course... you know, comedians never give up their sources of where they got funny stuff from. But
so this is a great example of, you know, the counter example to what I said, that movies take so long to get made. And sometimes it's like what is funny in the room, by the time this film hits screens, it's not going to be funny anymore.
Right.
Because you're basing it too much on what's going on or what else people are laughing at or what have you. This is kind of the opposite, where, you know, it got mixed reviews when it came out because it wasn't thought of as funny as their other films, and yet it's aged in some ways better than their earlier comedies. You know, it's like it got funnier. And why do you think that is? Because is it that the further we got away from, for example, World War I, or the more wars we lived through, or this, the more it became okay to laugh at this kind of stuff? I'm curious.
I think that would be part of it. I also think it's, you know, this is just 1931, 1932. So we're just a little bit, 1933 is just the beginning of sound era. So we have just left silent comedy, and we're now just discovering the joy of verbiage in our movies. And yet, we don't realize how hard that is. And I think as more movies come on and more pertain to be comedies than they aren't, that we look back then to a 1933 film to go, look at how much they got right, and how much they got right effortlessly, mm-hmm. and how much they didn't even know could go wrong.
Well, that's
like, to me, that was the indicator that nobody had been making terrible comedies, and suddenly the Marx Brothers show up. There have been hilarious comedies in the silent era, but that was never the Marx Brothers thing. So as soon as sound came in, they go, who do we got around here that's very funny on stage and that does a lot of jokes and funny stuff? And the Marx Brothers totally fit the bill for a new technology and a new form of comedy.
You know,
and so
two things are fascinating, I think you'll find interesting. One is that my number three film is Duck Soup from the Marx Brothers.
No.
Yes.
That's come on.
My number three as well. And the other thing that was interesting was to find a couple of critics at the time, influential critics, who disliked it because they said the depiction of politics is so dated. So the basic plot, if I'm getting this quite right, is, you know, this wealthy woman played by the inimitable Margaret Dumont, right, insists
right.
that Rufus D. Firefly be made leader of this small bankrupt country, Fredonia, before she'll continue to back it financially. Like, she's the financial backing
for
this country,
the Republic,
and she won't keep paying for it unless her man is installed.
Right.
And meanwhile, the neighboring country, which I think is Sylvania, is they're trying to annex the country and foment a revolution and woo Miss Teasdale, Margaret Dumont, to turn her against Rufus T. Firefly and Fredonia. So anyway, and part of it involves trying to dig up dirt by sending in spies. Oh my God, it's like I'm watching CNN right now. It's Spygate. It's Spygate on the campaign,
Spygate.
Right? I mean, because that's the thing. Isn't it interesting? Like, one of the things the critics said is that figures like Mussolini are passé. Boy, there's some brilliant insight. 1933. Right. Yeah, Mussolini's not going to give you any trouble.
Yeah, that guy. He's old news.
And here we are. You know, 2018, and famously, right, our president kept a book of Mussolini speeches by his bed. You know, so yeah, it's gotten funnier. It hasn't.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
proved not to be passé. Sadly, but also for the benefit of people who love film comedy. My number three. So what?
Awesome.
What is your number two, Dean?
My number two then is, you know, we all have experiences seeing, that I'm split on number two. But of course, to me, it's the experience if a person has the ability not to watch these silent films at home by yourself, but in a theater full of people, is to hear the miracle that is silent film comedy. And to me, I went to CineSpace. Oh, no, the silent film thing on Fairfax. Is that still there, by the way? No,
I think the silent theater is there, but CineFamily, which stopped showing silent films in any way, but CineFamily's gone because of the sexual assault there.
But, God damn it.
Yeah, but the theater is still there. Although before it was CineFamily, right? The guy that ran silent theater got killed there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's cursed in all sorts of ways. But
you went to a wedding there. You went to a wedding there, though. Are those people still married?
Yes, they are.
So it's not cursed in all ways.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
Okay, good
but,
point.
But what movie did you see there? What silent comedy did you see there?
I saw Harold Lloyd in Safety Last. And this is the story of the guy who has a great idea to get promoted up from retail floor sales to hire the human fly to climb up the side of the building. However, that guy's in trouble with the law. So he tells Harold Lloyd, just climb up one story and I'll meet you up at that story. But then he has to keep shaking the cop. So Harold Lloyd has to climb seven stories by himself, with every level being more and more precarious. And then finally getting to the top, and even that's more precarious and just death-defying. But in terms of the amount of laughter that went from the opening scene to the very final credits, it was nonstop. And it was, I think it was Mother's Day or Father's Day. So there were children in the theater, adults, grandparents. And this thing was a revelation, because I had seen parts of it before. I had seen bits of it at home, on lines, that sort of thing. But then to see the whole thing on a big screen in a room packed was the most fun and the most laughter I've ever had any movie ever give me. And this is Safety Last.
Now, I've never asked you this before, but The Truth Is Out There, you point out that the famous Harold Lloyd hanging from the clock tower was photographed directly across the street from your home in Los Angeles.
That's right.
And I am curious, did you know that was the specific location before you moved in there?
Did I know that was the specific location? I did not know that was the... No, when I moved in, I did not know that was the specific location. I knew it was on Broadway somewhere, because people pointed out that what you think is downtown New York is actually downtown Los Angeles, and a lot of those
silent
films.
I may be getting this a little bit wrong, but I think by 1920, there were 1 million people a day traversing Broadway in downtown Los Angeles. It was already that major a thoroughfare in downtown LA. So yes, it doubled quite successfully in many movies for New York.
Yeah. And because you can shoot down both 7th Avenue and Broadway and have it, look, because all the buildings were 12 stories high. So it was easy to make it look like the metropolis of Manhattan. He shot a lot of stuff. In fact, the building across the street from where he's hanging from the clock in Safety Last, he did another, I think it's feature length, called Feet First, where a guy wakes up in a burlap sack on a scaffolding halfway up the side of a building. And he does that all in the Broadway and 9th building that's right across the street from the Eastern Columbia. So, yeah, he filmed all around that area, particularly when construction boom was going on. And he was on the steel rafters. You know, he's doing all the steel girder gags that you now see in Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Is it safe to say that Harold Lloyd and Charlie Chaplin were rivals? I mean, they might have been friendly rivals, but is it safe to say they were rivals?
Absolutely. I think they shared... I mean, Chaplin did a little more box office, but in terms of the big three, it's Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd, and Charlie Chaplin.
So,
in terms of silent film comedy.
So how great, then, that Harold Lloyd is hanging from that clock in that iconic image we always think of, almost directly across the street from Chaplin's headquarters, United Artists.
That's right. United Artists. I know.
It's like in your face, in your face, Chaplin. Like Chaplin looking out his office. Chaplin looking out his office going, is that Lloyd pulling a stunt?
Though I think it was still under construction when Lloyd was hanging across, because that's 1927. And that building only began construction. The United Artists building began construction in 27.
I've never actually seen it in a theater, but, you know, beyond that stunt and beyond the whole buildup to it and the sequence to it, it's a really good film. The story is really, really, I don't know, it enfolds you.
Yes, right? Yeah, and you're rooting for everyone. So, yeah, safety last. Can't get enough of it.
Okay, well, my number two is one that we've already discussed. I'll mention just a couple more things about it that I particularly love. You mentioned George C. Scott in a performance that is the closest to if somebody was playing my dad in a movie. And that's Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, which is the actual name, more commonly known as Dr. Strangelove. I love political satire. I love dark comedy. And although I've learned to not love how hard they are to make. I wanted to talk about a little bit the comedy. George C. Scott is one of them. But the comedy that is, I don't know, brought out of actors that, again, up until Dr. Strangelove, you wouldn't think of using for a comedy.
Right. Like Leslie Nielsen. As we talked about last time.
In Airplane, yeah.
Yeah.
How about Sterling Hayden as General Ripper?
Yeah.
I mean,
now there,
that performance, I used to, in back in the day when I was a little pretty boy actor, for about a cup of coffee, you know, and you have to have monologues prepared just in case, right?
Right.
I had one of General Ripper's monologues prepared.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, but ice cream, children's ice cream, mandrake. You know, the fluoridation of water.
It's the purity of essence.
Purity of essence. Yeah, I mean it's great. He's playing a conspiracy theorist that could be plopped into a movie today.
Absolutely unhinged, but totally committed to his beliefs.
Yeah,
and not winking either. Right? There's no.
No, not at all. Yeah, not at all.
Yeah. It's like,
which is always why. Now, he had, of course, worked with Kubrick before in the heist picture, The Killing, Sterling Hayden.
Oh,
and
right.
Of course, famously blacklisted. And but he also kind of brings the same sort of playing it straight and therefore is so funny approach to a movie that was on my top 10 when we did our top 10 mysteries, when I talked about Altman's The Long Goodbye, the Philip Marlowe piece set in the early 70s. Sterling Hayden plays the author in it, and he does it, and his one caveat to doing the film was if he could write all his own lines. And again, just like in Strangelove, he gets some terrific monologues that he just plays straight, and they're so hilarious. He really understood why he was funny and never tried to be funny at all. It's a film of so many joys. And then somebody who was often funny, Keenan Wynn, who was a Breakfast Clubber, by the way. Oh, my God, playing it so straight. He comes in and plays it so straight. He's the by-the-book officer, Keenan Wynn, this guy who's such a known comedy actor. And instead of coming in and bringing the funny, he brings the serious. He brings the threat to it, but he gets one of the great lines in motion picture history all about the Coca-Cola company.
Oh, yeah, it's so good.
So that's
hilarious.
That's my number two. That's Dr. Strangelove. Please, Dean, tell me about City Lights.
Ah, Well, here's your surprise. It's not
what?
City Lights.
What? That didn't make your top 10? City Lights did not make your top 10?
Okay.
I have sat through presentations you've given on City Lights, and that did not make it. I'm getting married in the theater that was designed to house the premiere of City Lights, and you're not doing City Lights.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm doing City Lights.
No, you City don't
Lights,
have to.
Of course. No. Because, I mean, when we get to Chaplin, you got too much to choose from, right? And your caveats of what makes brilliant comedies is not just plenty of gags, laughs, laughter all the way through, but poignancy. And man, the final scene in City Lights is one of the most affecting acting and emotional moments in cinematic history. We knew that this was a risk because it was a silent film in the year 1931. Technology, nobody wanted old-fashioned silent movies anymore. And yet it got a 20-minute standing ovation and ran for the next 2 years at the very Los Angeles Theater to sold-out houses, which I believe that thing holds 2,000 people, doesn't it?
To sell that 1,200, out. I think. It's 1,200.
1,200. Well, that's still a lot of tickets to sell every day and sell it out. But then I'm going, okay, so... Well, what's been the theme of my list, of course, has been also brilliance in terms of the time of how craft and going and breaking the rules. And how about The Kid, a feature length comedy at the time when all comedies were just 15 minute shorts. He does a 40 minute story of an orphan that's taken away. It's there's tears. It's hilarious and yet heart-wrenching, but that's not even on my list. Because, good Lord, when in history does the world's funniest tramp look exactly like the world's evilest dictator that takes the globe into a global Second World War? I'm talking about The Great Dictator. This is Chaplin playing Hitler in a comedy. Mostly silent, except for the final speech, and made in 1940. Made in 1940, so America hadn't even gone into war yet. And yet here's a guy taking a world dictator down a notch, almost because he looks exactly like him, with the same mustache. So to me, that is ballsy. It's funny. It's epic, and historically, what a conjunction, what an intersection between comedy and terror.
So Chaplin is your number one, basically.
yeah,
but
kind
of. But are you saying kind of, do you remember what I said about Keaton, that the General is my favorite comedy that Keaton made? How do I have it? It's my favorite movie that he made, but Sherlock Jr. is my favorite comedy that he made.
Right. Yes.
And
is
that a little bit like
comedy because of the amount of mirth and joy and laughter you get from it?
Yeah. And is that kind of how you feel about Great Dictator versus City Lights? That City Lights is maybe the greater movie because of the rich package of it, especially the emotional pathos of it. Because like I said, that it didn't make my list because the movie just breaks my heart so much.
Yeah.
It's almost a rabid satirical bite of The Great Dictator. Is what you champion as a comedy.
Well, exactly. Except then, you know, I've been pointing out in the comparison of, say, Deadpool to Deadpool 2.
Dear God,
2,
if you bring up Monsieur Verdun, then we're ending the show. But please, keep going.
No, right. Not Monsieur. Modern times. Modern times of a guy stuck in a factory. That has so much energy and boundless, frenetic, comedic physicality to it that it's... if you are into that kind of thing, as I was as a kid, I thought that was his funniest movie ever in terms of its mocking modernism, in terms of robotics, I mean, you know, he has to test the lunch serving machine that beats him senseless. That's a hilarious sequence. So much in modern times has amazing pieces to it, as does the Great Tic Tac. So now I'm arguing against my own choice of number one. Now I'm thinking modern times. But the Great Dictator.
Because I always get Modern Times and Metropolis mixed up. I kind of do. Okay. I kind of do.
You got to watch them side by side. There's no
Which one did Giorgio Moroder do a score for? <All right. laughs>
Okay. So, yes. So, but in terms of if you want to see just how brilliant for watching a short film, I suggest everybody look up Charlie Chaplin in 1 a.m., a 20-minute comedy about a drunk coming home. That's it. There's no other actors, except maybe the cab driver, but he doesn't even react. It is literally Chaplin doing his drunk act in an apartment full of props and for 20 minutes, solid laughs until he finally falls asleep in the shower.
Okay.
I've been there.
And then The Immigrant and the Gold Rush. Go.
Oh my gosh. Okay, Immigrant, how great is this set of the ship rolling back and forth?
I actually,
and him holding the plates.
That my Immigrant might be my favorite.
Is that
Chaplin,
right?
Of Chaplin. It might be. Yeah, it's really good. It's really, really good.
And what a tale of everybody's experience of coming to America. And Gold Rush, of course, that is a epic in filmmaking, just in terms of taking everybody up the mountainside in that shot. That was up by Reno in Truckee, Nevada, and sequences, eating the shoe, dancing with the rolls that I just saw Johnny Depp do in Benny and June, for crying out loud. I didn't realize, I only just saw that Johnny Depp movie and realizing he's stealing Chaplin bits from the 1930s. So hilarious.
My look, no film of the sound era
yes,
ever had a better closing line than the one uttered by beloved Breakfast Clubber Joey Brown in 1959 when he says, "Nobody's perfect, and nobody might be perfect, but some like it hot." Is the perfect screen comedy. And in fact, I think it is a perfect film from any angle that you do it. 1959, already looking like a period piece because of how effectively they recreated the production design, costumes, etc., cinematography of the late 1920s. It looks like a gangster film that could have been made then, let alone set then. It's a romantic comedy musical. And when I say it's perfect, I mean, here is a romantic comedy musical set in the world of show business and gangsters that believably parodies show business, that gives you the thrills and the actual sense of suspense and danger that you need to drive the story forward, that is so romantic and moving, surprisingly so. Marilyn Monroe breaks your heart. Her vulnerability. If you've ever wondered why Marilyn was a star, not, you know, she was beautiful, but why she was a star, why people put up with all the problems, like why Billy Wilder put up with the problems of needing 90 takes of her just coming in and grabbing a water bottle. When you see the finished film, no one had more affecting vulnerability on screen than Marilyn, and could in turns make you laugh and break your heart. And when the movie has musical numbers, the music's fantastic. It's funny when it wants to be. It's sexy. It's romantic when it wants to be. It's scary. It's suspenseful. The cast was never better. Tony Curtis.
So funny.
Contributing a Cary Grant impersonation. A star-making performance for Jack Lemmon. I don't know if anybody's ever been better than him in that movie. The supporting cast, especially the gangster actors, George Raft, for example, terrific. The screenplays by Billy Wilder and his longtime writing partner, I.A.L. Diamond, and they were never better. It's about two musicians who dress in drag in order to escape mafia gangsters whom they witnessed commit a crime inspired by the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Beautiful black and white cinematography. It was well reviewed at the time, not the masterpiece that The Apartment the next year would be hailed to be. But of course, it's gone on to be considered one of the greatest films of all time. In fact, the AFI voted it as their top comedy on the 100 years, 100 comedies poll. It's one of the great films, period. But also, the humor is so modern, and it's notable for obviously featuring cross-dressing, for playing with the idea of homosexuality, which in and of itself actually led to the movie being produced without approval from the Motion Picture Production Code, the Hays Code, named for Will Hays, who wrote the production code. Will Hays, wait for it, a Breakfast Clubber. So it goes ahead. Billy Wilder goes ahead and makes the movie without approval from the Motion Picture Production Code. Now, the code had been weakening in its scope since the early 50s. Do many people think to the increasing social tolerance for some previously taboo topics? Think about earlier in the year when Anatomy for a Murder comes out and they're talking about rape and they're getting into really clinical terms about it in the court case. They're using the actual terminology that a real court case would use. So taboo adult topics. But to say that the code was weakening because people were okay with these topics is to underestimate the influence that television had. Movies knew they needed to compete with television, so they decided to push the envelope by having more adult topics explored than television, which relied on advertising money and therefore family hours, could afford to do. But the bottom line is still the same. The code had been weakening. But it's Some Like It Hot, where Billy Wilder, an independent producer, decides to go ahead and make the movie without the approval from the Hays Motion Picture Production Code. And the movie is so overwhelmingly successful that it kills off the Hays Code completely.
Wow.
A comedy ends the Motion Picture Production Code. Some Like It Hot. There was a time when I would watch this movie once a week and I would just be astonished at how accomplished everything and everyone in it is. The costumes, the production design, the cinematography, and this cast and the pacing and the use of editing. Sometimes Billy Wilder is thought of as more of a writer and a producer than a director. But if you wonder whether or not he could have been a stylish visual director in any era, I say watch Some Like It Hot.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I think there's so much about it. Sometimes I was wondering if the cross-dressing thing is becoming dated. But because it is a plot point and not just a Milton Berle gag for no reason, then it still, to me, it holds up for sure. It's really funny. It was on my list, but got kicked out because of Safety Last.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fact that they really fear for their lives, and you believe they fear for their lives, that makes it work.
Yeah. Yeah, they're playing that for real.
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, it's Bosom Buddies.
Yeah. Ain't that true.
Which we will discuss next week when we talk about our 10 all-time favorite sitcoms.
That we're not doing that.
No, we're not. And it wouldn't be on there, I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
Honorable mention, except that it wasn't honorable and we won't mention it. That right. brings us to the end of this two-part installment of our all-time top comedy feature films. We talked about what? Like at least 30 films, I think.
30, for sure. Yeah, I was all over the place.
So exciting. All right. Totally. Well, that brings us to the end of it. We'll be back with a normal show, whatever that means, where we talk about the latest show business news, the latest celebrity deaths, the latest school closings, the latest school shootings, movies, maybe.
Movies.
Television yeah. news, celebrities behaving badly, and so much more. You can find every show we've ever done at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. Can people like us on Facebook, Dean?
Oh, please like us. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. You can like us and do all the other things. And you can email us. We're at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Send us an email and follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
That's right. Hashtag we give good hashtag. Until next week.
Yes, we do.
I'm Phil Larinus.
I'm Dean Haglund. We'll see you then.
Belated spoiler alert.